Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I've heard that electric cars are just as bad for the environment as regular cars. Is this true?
Do you have questions about the climate emergency? Well, The Climate Question is the podcast where you'll find the answers.
It's important for all of us trying to think about, understand, and affect change in the world.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Life Scientific. Today I'm at the 2024 Cheltenham Science Festival, and more specifically, I'm on stage at the Parabola Arts Centre in front of a very friendly-looking audience. So you might be familiar with seismology, the study of earthquakes, but what about astroseismology, which looks at vibrations in stars? Well, that's the vast, information-rich field of celestial research championed by my guest today. Connie Arts is Professor of Astrophysics at the University of Leuven in Belgium. Her work has broken new ground, helping to improve our understanding of stars and their structures. It hasn't been an easy path. Connie describes herself as always being something of an outlier, but being a rebel seems to have paid off. Today, with a veritable galaxy of awards under her belt, Connie's involved in interstellar studies collecting data from thousands of stars and taking astroseismology to a whole new level. Professor Connie Arts, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Okay, Connie, let's kick off by adding a bit more detail to my rather simplistic definition there. What is astroseismology?
Yeah, so it is actually the study of waves inside stars. And so stars are hot gaseous spheres, and some of them have these complex up and down motions that creates waves, and they travel through the gas, and it's actually the only way for us to see inside a star.
Because what we're actually seeing is the light, but it's that light that is affected, right, by these waves, these vibrations.
Exactly. The vibrations make the gas move up and down, and so they become a bit more brighter or dimmer. And if we measure that during a period of time, a long, long time, then we can unravel the physics of these waves, and that's fantastic.
Wow. Well, you've clocked up various achievements and awards during your career, but as I mentioned, you've often referred to yourself as an outlier. Why is that?
Yeah, because I tend to be an outlier in many respects. So that started when I was a young girl. I went to a boys' school. That's an outlier, right? I tend to be somebody who does things differently in the way I do my science as a group event. I tend to focus on things that take a long time, longer than others, but then I'm first to discover them. So, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why I would consider myself an outlier.
Well, Connie Arts, let's go back to 1966, when you were born in Brasschaat in northern Belgium. What was it like as a place to grow up?
Oh, I lived very far in the countryside, so it was a little hard on me because I felt very isolated and I wanted to be more among other youngsters of my age. And so that's the downside. The upside is the stars are beautiful in the countryside when there is no light pollution. Mm. So it captured my attention from early days.
And tell me about your parents.
So my parents have hardly studied, so they really had no clue about what it is to be educated. And they also had a different path for me, because not out of bad will, but they just felt like studies are not a good investment because you don't earn money with them and you need money to earn a living. So they kind of were very different from what I am today, I'd say.
Mm. Growing up, well, you had two brothers, and I gather football was a big passion for all of you.
Yes, I spent my entire childhood next to the football terrains where my brothers were playing, and I really wanted to do that too, but I wasn't allowed because at that time girls weren't supposed to play football. I'm still upset about it today. Really upset.
And interestingly, as you mentioned, you ended up going to the local boys' school that your brothers attended. Tell me how that came about.
Well, I had to bike quite a long way as a six-year-old girl with my mother along a quite dangerous road to a girls' school. And so, as it happened, the director of the boys' school saw us biking, and after a week he came and told my parents, like, look, this is dangerous. Why don't you put her in the school where her brothers are? And that's how it happens.
Did you mind being the only girl in the class?
No. I learned how to fight, literally. And during the breaks, I was allowed to play football.
Ah, right. Yes. Tell me how your interest in astronomy in particular came about. Because not everyone who looks up at the night sky decides they want a career in astronomy.
No, that's true. And it's out of pure curiosity, actually, that I wanted to become an astronomer. So at one point, this same director who put me in the boys' school asked what I wanted to become. And I said, well, it doesn't matter because I will not be allowed to do the route that I would like to. And he said, well, tell me anyway. So I said, well, if I can choose, I'm really passionate about the stars. So he went to my parents and actually said, like, just let her do her thing because she has a talent for, you know, mathematics. And why don't you allow her to go to university and become a mathematics teacher?
I gather your mother wanted you to be a seamstress.
Yes, I hate that. You know, I'm very bad in it too. So I'm so grateful to this director. He saved my life, basically.
He persuaded your parents to yes. allow you.
Yes.
So in your final year of primary school, you sat down with this teacher. You devised a 10-year plan to make sure you got where you wanted to go. That's remarkably mature planning for a 12-year-old.
I know. I told you I was an outlier. So, yeah, he told me, like, if you really want to head for astronomy, you have to study mathematics anyway, so let's keep it a secret among the two of us that you're actually on the route to astrophysics, but just let the outside world think that you're going to become a mathematics teacher.
So, Connie Arts, off you went to secondary school, and at this point you had to go much further away to mm-hmm. attend a girls' school. Was that a shock to the system?
What a shock. What a shock, yes, because I entered a school where the habits were completely different.
In what way different?
Well, girls don't play football during the break. They don't literally fight. They quarrel with words. And so that was a refinement that I hadn't experienced yet, let's say.
Right. Yes, you had to adapt and fit in.
I had to adapt.
Well, Connie, in 1984, you got a place at the University of Antwerp yeah. to study mathematics. Mm-hmm. You graduated in 1988, having done a four-year course that earned you a teaching diploma as well. I guess that made your parents happy?
Yes, because they thought, she has a teacher's diploma, now she can go and work in a school and lecture mathematics.
But of course you had no intention of becoming a math teacher. Not, I should say, there's anything wrong with that as a career, of course. No. But for you, after graduating, you secured a place to do a PhD in astrophysics at the University of Leuven. And during the first year of your PhD, you came across stellar oscillations. Was it a new area at the time?
Well, it was an area that existed, but purely in theory. There were no really good observations except for the sun.
And your PhD thesis offered a mathematical method for pulsation mode identification using spectroscopic time series data. So what yeah. exactly does that mean?
So the theory was there. I was learning that in classes, but it was at a time when new instruments became available that were more precise in terms of capturing the vibrations at the surface of the star. But there were no methods to couple that theory to these vibrations to decide what kind of oscillations were ongoing. So my task was actually to couple the data to the theory and see if we could learn something about these oscillations.
And of course, learning about the oscillations helps you learn about the star itself, its chemical composition, temperature, mm-hmm. size, distance, mm-hmm. how they're moving. So there's a lot of information that you can squeeze out of this data.
Yes, and so the coupling between the theory and the data didn't exist at that time. And so by developing that method, which is quite mathematical, I sort of allowed myself to dive deep into the stars by extracting internal physics and chemistry by means of a solid theory.
And your conclusion was that because at this stage you could usually only detect one or two types of oscillations, that was merely the starting point, because what was really needed was much better data.
Yes, much better data assembled during a really long time. And I decided to specialize in big blue stars. And so the bigger the star, the longer you have to measure the vibrations. A long-term plan again, right? And so in that sense, it was really a journey where I had no clue how long it would take to find something, if at all.
Well, you got married and started a postdoctoral fellowship at the Research Foundation Flanders, known as the FWO. And that's where you began researching new data on the positions of many thousands of stars. That had been collected by the European Space Agency's Hipparchus satellite.
Yes, that's right. So by that time, the Hipparchus satellite had assembled more than 100,000 stars and good brightness variations, but not at all with a purpose for the oscillations. And then I thought, I'm going to try to use that data for something it's not at all meant for. And I discovered, literally thousands of stars. I could only see one vibration per star, but I had a big sample now. And so that was a different way of trying to reach my goal. Mm.
Your two children were born in 1994 and 98. During your time at the Foundation, you've spoken glowingly about the FWO as an employer, saying that it allowed you to become the scientist you wanted to be, an astro-mama and an astro-seismologist. What did you mean by that?
Yes, so I had the luck of having two fellowships, and the nice thing was that if you have your own funding, you can do what you want. I had young kids. It was a daily struggle. Yet I could go abroad for short periods and organize my life in the way I wanted to. So that has been a very critical set of fellowships. And the FAO was even super modern at that time already. It was an organization who automatically provided 1 year extra to young mothers in science. If you had a kid, you got 1 year longer. Now this is modern standard. At that time, it was revolutionary. Mm. And for me, it was critical to have that support, actually.
Well, at the turn of the millennium, Connie, you were invited by the European Space Agency to become a member of their advisory team for something called the Eddington Project. Now, this was a space telescope designed to use astroseismology to determine the size and composition of stars, as well as to search for Earth-like planets that might harbour extraterrestrial life, which is something that many people are very excited about. You were still quite young, though, for such a big and sort of responsible role. What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I was taken on board by those who had come up with the design of the Eddington satellite. It moved me into astronomical instrumentation. So it was a new world. And it also made me realize, you know, the European Space Agency has many member states, 22. You have to learn how to collaborate, how to go together with one aim, how to speak different languages even. I did more astrosociology than astronomy sometimes. And it also hooked me onto engineers who have to build a very expensive machine that must be able to answer scientific questions. So you have to translate your scientific questions into hardware requirements. And I love that whole new branch of astronomy that I wasn't aware of or wasn't so familiar with at that time.
And around about this point, you also secure a lectureship at the university's Institute of Astronomy. And here we come to something that you yourself have described as a eureka moment. Towards the end of 2002, during your Christmas break, you came across something while analysing data from the telescope at La Silla Observatory in Chile. Now, first of all, set the scene for me. What was the background to this work?
Yeah, the background to this work was that I went back to my roots after having found many stars that pulsate. I realized now I have to combine the big sample but with individual stars that are the best suitable to do astroseismology. And I was following a star, measuring it for more than 20 years. My supervisor had actually started it. And I knew the longer you measure, the better you can determine the vibrations. And so all of a sudden in this Christmas break, where I tend to be in my home bubble, I all of a sudden for this star saw 6 vibrations instead of only 2 or 3. And there was the pattern that I was aiming for as a PhD student. And I said, yes, I see a pattern. I can unravel the oscillations. And this is going to tell me a lot about actually how the gas in the star rotates.
An exciting moment?
Yes, I shouted. I shouted, and I was at home with my daughter. She was 9 at that time. She was making drawings downstairs. So I shouted, yes. She complained like, mother, again, you're the nerd. You know, stop doing that.
Yeah. But of course, you know, what this did do is it led to you delivering the first evidence of non-rigid rotation in a massive star, meaning its core rotates faster than the outer envelope.
Yes.
What does that tell us?
That tells us a lot because, you know, stars rotate, but we can only measure it from the outside, while my waves allowed me to measure it
right in
the interior. Now, if you have more rotation, then the material mixes more effectively. I always compare that with coffee with milk, you know. If you like that, you pour milk into your coffee, you take a spoon and you bring angular momentum to the fluid. That's the same inside the star. If the core rotates faster than the envelope, the material, which is a hot gas, it mixes more. And if you have a more mixed gas, then the star lives longer, actually. So I knew that measuring this rotation was only done that far for the sun. And then I added another star, a big blue star that will later explode as supernova. So I knew this would be something of a breakthrough, actually.
It is fascinating stuff. Well, Connie, you continued climbing the career ladder, making full professor in 2007. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, two major space telescope missions had been launched. There was CORO, a collaboration between the French and European space agencies, and the Kepler mission from NASA, both involving astroseismology. Very briefly, give me a sense of the sort of information they were looking for.
Yeah, so I was prepared with my theory, with my methodology. The only thing that was missing were data that are uninterrupted. You know, if you work and do this field from an Earth telescope, you can only observe at night, right? So there are gaps in the data. And if you study vibrations, these gaps are a killer. And so I knew if I have satellite data, not only would the data be more precise because it operates above the Earth atmosphere, so, you know, the light from the star is directly accessible, but it's the fact that you are uninterruptedly measuring that helps our field a really great deal.
And suddenly you have access to so much more data compared with what you had to work with during your PhD.
Yes, we had hundreds of thousands of stars and uninterrupted data. For the Kepler mission, it was uninterrupted for 4 years long. And so this was fantastic for an astroseismologist doing massive stars.
And your team had such success. You started working on a new subfield called gravito-inertial astroseismology. I hope you're all taking notes here. There's going to be a test at the end. Connie, maybe you can just give us a quick explainer. What is gravito-inertial astroseismology?
Yes, so it's a new subfield of astroseismology that particularly involves slow waves in fast rotating stars. So if you look at the sun has oscillations. We call that helioseismology. These are fast waves in a slow rotator. Fast means in 5 minutes, the solar oscillations make the surface go up and down, and the sun rotates in 26 days, right?
Right.
So 5 minutes over 26 days is a small number. My star, so to speak, well, nobody owns stars, but, you know, the ones that I was studying, they have their vibrations that take more than a day, but they rotate also only in 1 day or a few days. So they are really slow vibrations in fast rotators. And that means you have to take into account an extra force in the mathematics. That's called the Coriolis force. Mm. And so there was no astroseismology for that type of star. And it was necessary to develop it. It's harder mathematically, but it's so much more fun.
So in the sun, you can say, well, for all intents and purposes, I can assume the sun isn't spinning at all. I can assume it's not spinning, so I mean, can just know the waves.
Yeah.
But if it's spinning at the same rate that these waves are traveling through it, starts to get messy.
It starts to get messy, and you can no longer assume that while the star is vibrating, it rotates. You can't assume it doesn't rotate because, you know, it does with an equal period as the vibrations, right? We didn't know anything about the internal rotation of these stars. I had found the first one, but then I wanted to do that similar type of study, of course, for thousands of them. And so that was a long-term journey I started. But, you know, I know something about long-term journeys that might not end up with a big success just from primary school to astrophysics. And that's highly risky, maybe. It might take me long. We might not succeed. But in the end, you know, I'm a very optimistic person.
And you're used to taking on those big challenges.
Yeah.
Well, Connie, let's come to your current work. In 2013, the European Space Agency launched Gaia, a project to create an incredibly precise three-dimensional map of more than 1,000 million stars throughout the Milky Way galaxy and beyond. Now, this doesn't have an immediately clear link to astroseismology, but just last year, you discovered that this data can, in fact, be incredibly useful to you.
Yes, again, going back to my postdoc roots, where I used the Hipparco satellite to do something in astroseismology while it was not meant for it, I'm now doing it again with Gaia, which has billions of stars. And so this wasn't made to do astroseismology as a satellite, but I've discovered last year with my group that actually the dominant oscillations of hundreds of thousands of stars are in the data. And so now we can upscale from a few hundred massive stars to about 100,000 of them, where we know where to look. But now I need refined measurements of those. And we're building a machine that will help us do that.
So that's building the instrumentation, but how about the current theories? I know that they still can't fully explain a lot of the precision data that we're getting from space.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So even though we have mathematical methods, they are too simple because all our models of stars, these are computer models, they assume the stars to be spheres if they don't vibrate. And that's perfectly fine for the sun. I mean, you can check that with your eyes, basically. But fast rotators are flattened, and so then stars are spheroids instead of spheres. They're flattened more like an egg, if you like. And we don't have a good theory to describe that while we need it. So I'm going to develop that with a group of four different institutes. And again, it's actually a project that is labeled as, this is insanely difficult. It might not work. It's high risk. But that's why the European Research Council gave me a big pot of money to try for the next 6 years. So this is another big long-term project. That's on the modeling mathematical side again.
So after all the success and achievements, Connie, I have to ask, do you still feel like an outlier today?
Of course, because I'm doing my hobby. I can do it with a nice team. But I still feel like I'm doing this new mathematical development that is really hard, else it would have been tried before. But I want to go for it. So, yeah, that fascinates me.
Right. Time for some questions from the audience here at the Cheltenham Science Festival. Now, if you'd like to ask Connie anything about space missions, studying stars, or forging your own path in astrophysics, raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. First question there.
For young girls now who are studying physics and maths and are just starting on that journey, what would your advice be?
Thank you for that question. I have many types of advice, but my main one is do it your way, even though different from all others. That's what I did, and it worked out. And young women, young girls should not think that they're not capable of doing things that they would like to do. So whenever there is a lack of self-confidence, I'm here to beat it. So really, follow your passion and curiosity, and it will all be fine.
So I'm interested in your background again about coming from a working class background and, you know, a woman and all the rest of it, where do you get your confidence from that background? Because I think that's inspiring for not just girls, but working class people as well.
Absolutely. And there is a huge amount of talent out there in families that do not really have necessarily equal access to education. And so it's very important to catch these talents. Now, that's also why I'm going to schools to give interviews and to encourage every talent. And so it hasn't stopped me from saying what I think should be said. I'm not particularly shy, I think, but I used to be. And it's actually thanks to this director of my primary school that I learned to overcome being shy and living in my own bubble. So it's really important that you encourage youngsters to dare to live up their dreams and to follow their passion. Already from the primary school, I would say.
For yourself and amongst your colleagues, do you ever have discussions about the infinite or spiritual dimension to the world?
Yes, you have all kinds of people who are very much into the spiritual or very nerdy physicists. There's no right or wrong. I tend to try to bridge these aspects. And for myself, I would say that the universe is big, it's beautiful, and the stars are beautiful.
I always think that when we talk about a spiritual emotional feeling among scientists, it doesn't necessarily mean at some supernatural level, but simply the awe, the beauty of the natural world, of the universe, affects us deep down.
Yes, I agree with
that
you.
We can call that spiritual.
I agree. Yeah. And, you know, the tiny little girl looking up in me, that was also sort of spiritual.
Well, that's all we have time for, unfortunately. Huge thanks to our wonderful audience here at Cheltenham's Parabola Arts Centre, and, of course, to Connie Arts. Thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
With pleasure.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are battling to become the next president of the United States. But what will the result mean for the rest of the world? The BBC World Service brings you trusted news, analysis, and insight. Never miss a breaking story with the Global News Podcast. Hear the human stories behind the big issues on The Documentary. And for in-depth analysis of a major news story, listen to The Global Story. Search for The Global News Podcast, The Documentary, and The Global Story, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.